Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast. Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. Thank you so much for your really wonderful messages about our first episode of Series 4, which was last week with Lucy Porter. She's an incredible human being and it was really nice to get all your messages on Twitter and on Instagram, on the email. If you don't follow us already, you can follow us on @TheGriefcast on Twitter and Instagram. And I've been running some book competitions and giveaways on the Instagram lately, just some grief books. So do head over there, or if you're on Instagram, do follow us, because I have been just giving away some books and flowers when I have them to give away. And if you did enter and commented or got in touch, thank you so much. I really hugely appreciate it. It is not always the easiest show to make, so it's always very nice to know that you are listening and appreciating. Thank you. This week's guest is the incredible writer and journalist Anna Whitehouse. You may know Anna by her nom de plume? Yeah, that's the word, which is Mother Pucker. She is an amazing woman. She is a journalist, as I said. She also wrote a book called Parenting the Shit Out of Life with her husband Matt, which is an extremely frank and very funny, honest take on parenting. She's done a TED talk as well. She campaigns for what she calls the Flex Appeal, which is to give more flexible working to parents to make their lives happier and easier, and everybody basically happier and easier. She's a really inspirational woman, a brilliant communicator. Anna came in to talk to me about the five lives that she lost on her journey to becoming a mother. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here with broadcaster and author Anna Whitehouse. Hello. Author of Parenting the Shit Out of Life, which did you write like 2 weeks after you'd had your second baby? Is that right?
Well, we finished it about, I was on my hospital bed tapping out the last chapter.
What, after baby, hospital bed?
No, just pre, having contractions on the bed.
And you were writing while having contractions?
Well, I just didn't feel like having the baby was a better option. So I thought, okay, get it. There's nothing quite like a real life deadline.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I'm one of those people that if I have a year to write something, I'll still do it in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, same.
That was my issue. I don't know. I need the adrenaline rush.
I hate it about myself so much. I've never, ever written anything like beforehand. It's always the last couple of hours thinking, I could probably do it now.
Yeah.
I reckon there's 20 minutes I could get it done.
Who are these people who luxuriate?
I know. I actually don't know any writers who do that, actually.
It says rip the plaster off.
Yeah. I know people who did it at school and university, like, oh, I've done that essay. But people who write professionally, I don't know anyone who wasn't like, I'm up, like the deadline's coming and I'm doing it now. So maybe that's a sign of a good writer.
I kind of just do it with everything. Like I went to the wrong children's party yesterday. I literally turned up at the wrong venue, but there was another children's party there.
I've done
and
that, yes.
Turned up. I said, I'm here for Sophia's party. They're like, it's Terry's party. I think I can't remember what the name of the kid was even.
It
was
Terry is bold.
Terry's like 57. It's Terry's 60th. There was another completely different party. I'd got the wrong end of the stick. I was like, this is why I need like proper deadlines.
Yeah.
Like I don't work well when there's time.
No.
Because it's actually a party that's next weekend, you see. And that's me not focusing.
Yeah, you were on it. You were like, let's go now, let's get it done.
Rip that plaster off.
I only went to the wrong bit of the hall. There were two halls. And I was at the kids' party for ages. And I was like thinking, God, I don't know anyone. I don't know any of the kids. And then I was like, is this Martha's party? And someone was like, no, it's Alex's. okay. It's fine. And I found a door, went downstairs. I was like, oh, right, okay, Martha was downstairs.
My children have more of a social life than I do. Oh, I mean, they're literally hitting the tiles while I'm considering changing the tiles in my bathroom. Like, I'm thinking about grouting. And they're, you know, thinking about, should we get the Gruffalo for... I'm like, God, I haven't bought a birthday present for anyone in about 10 years.
Yeah, that's not under five.
That's not under five, yeah.
I think it's quite nice, though. I quite like going to the... Because I feel... Having not been to many, because obviously my little girl's only nearly two, but I quite like, I feel like less pressure than adult parties.
And there's, the pressure I feel is around the buffet food, which is meant for the child. You're desperate to kind of get stuck in, and then you go in going, I'm just going to get some sausage rolls for me.
I did slightly fight and push ahead of a child for some birthday cake for myself. I didn't quite realise I was doing it. I was like grabbing Colin, the caterpillar,
the head bit, or the bottom.
I grabbed it, pretending it was for my daughter, but I don't really let her have cake, so it was for me. And I saw a little kid like sort of look at me like, I was supposed to get that bit. And I had a real moment of like, oh.
Mine.
And I thought that wasn't great, but also I thought, fuck you. Fuck you, kid, you're too slow. Because I still feel like you're a child sometimes. You're like, well, I want the cake too.
I love that, like, that age five, you'd be like, fuck you.
Yeah, I was. I was like, you were too slow, mate.
Yeah.
And I didn't know him, you know what I mean? It wasn't like one that you felt bad. It was like it was some random kid. Random party kid. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Ones that they're like, your child is friends with, you feel bad for, but one you're like, who are you? Some, like, cousin? Of the birthday person? Who cares?
I know. It's like parenthood. You're expected to change overnight into some kind of like really caring, thoughtful person. No.
No, not when it comes to cake.
I'm still a massive camp.
I'm very thoughtful on lots of things, but not when it comes to cake.
I'm actually really good with strangers.
How are you?
I'm better with strangers than with people I know and love.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Depends what mood I'm in. I'm either amazing, that you think, God, that woman is absolutely charming, or you think, how is that person in comedy or involved in anything professional? Because she can't speak. Like, sometimes I get people being like, oh, she's an actor, is she? So it's not going
And they give
well.
You that kind of patronising arm squeeze.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, oh, well done on your podcast. Is it a podcast? Like, my mum doesn't really understand what any of it is. Well done on your things.
Yeah.
The things you do.
The things.
That, you know, make you money.
They always say to me, it's hard to... make a living out of it. That's what I always get. And I think, I wouldn't say that if someone said I'm an accountant, oh, must be boring. Like, you wouldn't go for the obvious.
No.
You'd be like, oh, that's great. Like, you know, like, don't obviously say what the cliche is, which, yes, it is hard. Yes, it is hard.
My dad calls it, because we do blogging on Mother Pucker.
Yeah.
He's like, how's the flogging going? I'm like, yeah, I haven't I've sold a few bits, you know, a few limbs on the internet, but like, I'm not like every day flogging. He's like, oh no, sorry, I mean, what is it, the flogging. I'm like, whatever it is.
Because Jimmy said, if people don't know you by Anna Whitehouse, they might know you by Mother Pucker.
Or Mother Sucker.
Mother Sucker.
If I'm doing a YouTube porn advert, depending which way you go.
Is there two sides. It's there for you.
Yeah.
So yeah, you are huge on Instagram, absolutely huge. And you have a blog and you vlog and you have a podcast as well. But it's mainly about parenting. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that's where we met, was at the podcast awards.
Yeah, yeah.
When you won. And we got bronze.
I didn't beat you, did I?
Well, I don't know. You won everything.
No, it was a different category.
It's fine. I'm fine with it. I'm fine.
I only say that because I very awkwardly did someone else's podcast, having no idea that I'd beat them in their, like, absolutely.
That you'd chat all over them.
And then they brought it up immediately. And I was like, no, you were in the something else. They're like, no, I was in that. I was like,
and there's nothing worse than somebody going, no, you did really, you got the prize for effort.
Yeah.
Don't you remember? I got the prize for excellence.
You were bronze for best family, though, weren't you?
Yeah.
See, I can't, I'm not entering the family. You're fine.
I'm joking. You're in the
mix. Yeah, so your podcast is called...
Dirty Mother Pucker.
Yes, Dirty Mother Pucker. You're really good at names. I think Parenting the Shit Out of Life, Mother Pucker and Dirty Mother Pucker are good names.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that's like... I like all of those things make me think, oh yeah, that sounds good.
Well, it was because when I was a journalist, I kept putting out pitches for the bit... After, you know, this year, when you have a baby and then suddenly you're expected to go from like Elle magazine to Mother and Baby.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, what is that bit in between? Like, I'm not suddenly going to, I don't just care about nipple teats. I genuinely want something to bridge that gap.
Yeah,
so that's
when
I was like, Mother, what the fuck is that? And then I was like, that's where it came from. But I obviously watered it down a little bit.
But it's brilliant.
Thanks.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Do I get gold?
Yes, you get a gold.
Just for today.
Carry out award.
Thank you.
Yes, and you do write a lot about parenting and you have two children yourself. But obviously, that's not quite why you're here to talk today about that side of your life. So who are we remembering today?
We're remembering...
So there's a weird question for what I obviously know what who we're remembering.
Yeah. It's so the five little lives that didn't make it Earthside. We had five miscarriages in... I say it is the process of having children.
Yeah.
I think it does... It started to feel like a process.
Wow, yeah.
And so, yeah, we're remembering... I wanted to talk about those five lives that still very much are with us.
So was that between your first child and... the one that survived, the second one that survived, yes.
So, I mean, you can speak, because it's spoken about so clinically by doctors, I sort of start speaking about. So we had three before my first daughter and two before the second.
Oh, okay, so you had three miscarriages before your first daughter. So how old were you when that happened?
So
were your first one when this sort of...
It was bizarre, actually, because we didn't... I've written about this in the book. We didn't want the first one, which sounds an awful thing to say.
Wow, right, but yeah, unexpected.
And it's something that I've really thought long and hard about even saying out loud retrospect how difficult it was to actually conceive and have a child in the end. But I was very young. Matt and I had known each other for 2 weeks and I got pregnant.
Whoa.
Your
body was... Like, this is the one.
Let's seal the deal. I was like, honey, we're going to have to change things up. And I was going through the process of having an abortion.
Wow.
And I had booked in. And in my mind, it was very much, this is the clear thing to do. We've known each other 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I was very young. We worked in the same company. And it didn't feel... like the right time.
Yeah.
There were many very personal reasons for that, but ultimately it didn't feel right for us. And so I'd booked in, and the day that I was meant to go in for an abortion, I started bleeding.
Wow.
And it was in a very bizarre, almost 360 degree turn of events where I just suddenly, the minute I started losing something that I actually didn't want, I wanted it.
Yeah.
I knew in that moment that I hadn't connected, I think, with pregnancy as a life, which sounds a really callous, cold-hearted thing to say. But I think we'd been told, you know, that pregnancy is terrible, 16 and pregnant, pregnancy is bad. And actually in that moment when I started bleeding at my desk at work, I rang up Matt and I said, I am bleeding. I don't want to lose this child. And in that moment, I think bizarrely, not only did we, it was more important that moment than any wedding or anything that came after that. We both just went, we do want this. And it was such a bizarre change of events within 30 seconds.
Wow. So, but I think it's such a difficult topic to talk about, which is why I admire you so much that you have been so open and honest about what happened to you. Because I think, especially for like counting the privilege that we live in, a very, you know, with a Western society with extreme easy access to these things, especially in this country compared to other countries.
Yeah.
It's really hard to talk about abortion and miscarriage and pregnancy without sounding like, I'm not saying abortion is bad, but it is a life. And that is, I think once you've had a child, it starts taking on a slightly different meaning. And I'm obviously very pro-choice and not saying at all that if you have an abortion, it's a bad thing. But it is a life. That is what's happening.
It felt like a word I couldn't say.
Yeah.
I think especially having miscarried then after that five times following, I think having made, you just feel like I'd made a decision, I didn't want this child.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you think, well, it actually wasn't a decision that was mine to make.
Mm.
And I think that was the moment that was very difficult. And I, you know, I'm agree with you. I'm totally pro-choice. I'm totally behind what anyone feels is right for their body, for that moment in time. But I did not count on shifting my perspective so quickly when actually realizing that decision wasn't mine or Matt's to make. Why am I mourning something I didn't even want?
Mm.
And I did want it, I think.
It's so complicated, isn't it? It's so complicated. And I think I know women that have had abortions, wanted them, had them, and still felt that, like, that loss of something, because it is a loss of something. And I think that's why I am pro-choice, because I feel like if a woman can say, not that we have to get into this, but like, you know, if a woman acknowledges, yes, this is so important and it is a real life that I can't do this and I'm going to let this life down, that's why. So it's sort of like the backwards argument, because I feel sometimes like with the argument pro-choice, it's like, oh, it's not real. It's just a thing. It's just a dot. It's not a person yet. And you're like, no, no, it is a life. And that's how seriously I take it. That if I can't look after it, I'm going to damage that life. Like, that's...
It is a life.
Why I need to be allowed to make the decision, because I could really fuck this up. So, yeah, did you feel... I mean, this, I don't mean this badly, but did you feel guilty that you were heading for that abortion?
I think the minute that I started bleeding. I say we, because it was like... I think men get cut out of the conversation so much in terms of...
And it's so tricky, because they're not the ones bleeding. So it's really hard to bring them in to that conversation.
I just didn't... I think every woman who goes through pregnancy, and obviously I came at it from a very different perspective at that point, not wanting that life, but anybody who goes through pregnancy, the minute you see that blood in your pants, there's a life that you're aware of. There is something that you can't ignore. And I felt extreme guilt, I think, for... in retrospect, not realising that the beginning of our... I thought it would just be easy to get pregnant. You know, I just thought it was a choice I had. You know, it's, like you say, incredibly privileged to have a child.
Yeah.
It's something that I feel privileged on a daily basis, every second of the day. I think, how did I, at that point, think, I'll just abandon this life because I made a mistake?
Yeah.
And that's my... feelings of guilt. I did blame myself from that point onwards, because we went on to have 3 miscarriages after that. I think there was an element of guilt laced into every single miscarriage that happened from that point. Like, it
and
wasn't
I only
my decision.
Say that because, not because you should feel guilty, because
you're not miscarriage guilting me.
Yeah. But because I know how I would feel as a woman. Like, and I know that the torture women do to themselves, and I know that it'd be so easy to be like, oh, well, there you go. Like, you know, that's what happened. Like, because we are so amazing at torturing ourselves. So you had that miscarriage, and obviously that was the first one. Did you feel like, how long did it take you to sort of process it? Did you feel like you moved through it easily, or did it sort of hang, did the grief stay with you for a while?
It was really, I think, there are very few moments in your life where you go from one extreme to the other. And when Matt and I was in hospital miscarrying, and I remember them saying, do you want to see the fetus?
Was this the first time?
This was the first time in hospital. Matt and I had been going out for 2 weeks. We'd probably had sex twice.
So you started bleeding, you took yourself to hospital?
Yeah, it was within the same day. And then we were rushed. It was quite a bad situation. And Matt, I remember him lying on the floor overnight with one of those like woolen blankets. And it was that moment when the sonographer was putting the sort of gel on my stomach and said, I'm sorry, it's bad news. And she didn't know that obviously we were
planning
for it not to happen. See, I can't even say it. You know, like it's a really weird thing. I can't even believe that I was in that position of thinking I had that choice.
Yeah.
And so I remember Matt saying, yes, he wanted to see it. And can you imagine, I'm not trying to make light of this, but we'd been going out 2 weeks. We'd had a few drunken 4 a.m. sessions, like full on mashup.
Wow.
Like, we were in the first throes of romance. And then you go from, you know, beer and a burger down Wetherspoons to A&E lying on the floor. Do you want to see your inviolable fetus?
Wow.
It was just like, Jesus fucking Christ.
You get through that, that is a pretty good standing point, isn't it?
Like, that's when we got married.
Yeah.
Like we both said that was the point when we actually were like, we're in this now.
Wow.
We faced something that I don't think many couples were faced within 2 weeks of your time together. I mean, we cut straight to the grief. I think I saw who he was in that moment, and I will never forget walking down that hot, it was like running the maternal gauntlet, walking down they put me on a maternity ward.
Why do they do that? I don't understand. Every woman who's been through that says that to me, and I always think, is it beds? Is it lack of beds? Or is it like, we just don't know where to put you? Like,
I was in a room with a woman who was contracting.
Oh my God.
So it was just this tale of two like morbid sides. One
screaming because she's having, it was simply a line between life and death. And we were on the same, in the same room. And I just remember watching Coronation Street, just eating. And I remember eating a coronation sandwich, the coronation chicken sandwich. And I remember trying to, we had to find some light in this dark.
Yeah, of course.
And I was like, Matt, I'm watching Coronation Street and I've got a coronation chicken sandwich. And he was like, you're better than that, Anna. You're better than that. I was just like, and he's Scottish. I'm trying to do a Scottish accent. You're better than that, Anna. I was like, I know. I mean, we have basically gone on two dates, decided to have an abortion, ended up having a miscarriage, and now we're in A&E, and I'm talking about coronation chicken sandwich. I'm sorry that my chat isn't up to scratch.
Yeah, sorry, babes.
Sorry, babes.
Got some stuff on my mind right now.
Got some stuff on my mind. But yeah, it was a weird, a very bizarre time, and I think there was grief that kind of weighed down from that point. But
it must have been so hard. I can't even imagine. That must have been so hard to even go from that shift. I think it's hard to be like, oh, actually I do want a baby, actually. Like, that in itself would be a huge emotional roller coaster, to then have to lose that life and then be around women popping them out. It's like
all within 24 hours.
Yeah,
it was basically
hell,
like
so dramatic, Anna.
It was just, and I, and the worst thing, the thing I can't deal with is that the abortion clinic, then obviously I hadn't told them that I wasn't coming in, so then was getting kind of messages and phone calls saying, where are you? And it was just like, it was an absolute, it was like nightmare on maternity ward.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And there is, you know, I'm laughing about it in a kind of manic way, but when, like I say, I was in two minds about even mentioning the word abortion in the same sentence as miscarriage. But since opening up that discussion, so many people have come forward with that weight of guilt.
Yeah.
Women who have had abortions and then have miscarried and feeling like there is a link between the two. And I think medically, I've spoken to a lot of people, they can't, there isn't.
I think don't
bear the burden of that guilt, because every single pregnancy, every single decision you make, where you, what point you are in your life, is going to be different.
It's a bit like when people, it's a bit like when you talk about losing a parent, and you are, this is a long metaphor, but there's a, if you're happy with where you are now, and you know that partly you owe that to your parent dying, and there's a guilt of that, like, oh, I'm happy now. Does that mean I'm happy they're dead? And it's not. It's not. It's just like, well, this is where I am. And I think that's the thing with abortion and miscarriage. It's like, if you hadn't have had that abortion, that doesn't mean other miscarriage wouldn't happen, or that that life would be, you would be wonderful. That life that you close the door on, you can't open that door and like, oh, there's unicorns over there and it's amazing.
Yeah.
But it's easy to torture yourself and go, oh, well, if I hadn't. But it's not the truth if that's not how life works.
Tortured myself. It's exactly that.
Yeah, that decision doesn't lead to that. That's not how, the gods above didn't go, well, now she will have this to punish her. But that's how you feel. I completely understand that.
It's punishment. I think that's actually it. It feels, you know, you're being punished for that decision. When I miscarried, when we had my, I had my first daughter, May, and we were trying to get pregnant for the second time, I remember, again, it feels, the way, reason I sort of laugh, like, I'm one of those people that laughs at funerals, but not...
You're in the right like place. This is where we are. This is where the gang is. This is the people
it's
who
like
laugh.
A manic, like when talking about anything...
It's either you laugh or cry.
It's very much that line, life and death in that maternity ward, pregnant woman having contractions versus woman with inviolable fetus.
Yeah.
It's the same. Like, I just, that line between kind of deep sadness and hysterical laughter is so thin for me. And my daughter knew I was pregnant because we were about sort of 9 weeks, and she'd seen that I was pregnant, and I knew I was miscarrying, and I'd gone into her nursery to pick her up, and she was like, Mama, why are you crying? And I had, like, she called it the black tears, where your mascara is kind of down your face. And I hadn't even noticed, but I was just kind of in a bit of a mess. And I was in the nursery and I miscarried at nursery, and she was in the toilet with me. And again, it's these worlds colliding where you're hearing the cacophony of all these children like squawking outside. And she's like, why are you crying? Why the black tears? And I just felt, I can't lie to you because you knew, she knows I was pregnant. And yeah. I just said, Mummy, Mummy has lost a baby, but it's not Mummy's fault. Mm. You know, this is just what's happened. And she said, oh, it was just very matter of fact. Oh, where did you lose it? I was like, oh, God. As I was literally like, well, it's, oh, God, it's in the top. I can't even articulate it. I said, look, I didn't lose the baby. Sometimes it just doesn't work out. And she said, but you can have another one. Well, yeah, I hopefully can. Yeah. And she said, can the doctor put another one in? I was like, well, we'll have to talk to Papa about
that.
Yeah,
we'll talk to Daddy about that, not the doctor.
The doctor's going to slip me one. We're going to need to talk to Papa about that. And then the thing that literally turned me around from feeling that nightmarish scenario again was she said, can the next one be black? Like my friend Zion. And I was like, again, going to have to talk to Papa about that one. And it was her just questioning, just really simple questioning. Without that, I think as adults, we feel a need to instinctively protect somebody. Whereas actually her line between sort of life and death was quite factual.
Yeah.
And it was, well, you can just have another one. And her way of actually dealing with that, she was three at the time. And I was in two minds about even having this conversation. Mm. But she just held my hand and just said, you know, we'll just have another one. We'll call it Zion. yes, we will.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, you know, again, those lines crossing.
Yeah.
And it felt very bizarre, but I weirdly felt uplifted by a three-year-old in a way that adults have tried to make your loss okay.
Yeah.
When actually you do just sometimes need more of a factual look you in the eye and go, it's going to be okay. I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm in the hole with you. And yeah, let's go and work on that brother for me called Zion. Okay.
I'll leave you guys to it.
Yeah.
I've told you what I want. However it happens is up to you. Yeah, it's interesting. I think that thing about being honest with kids is very important. I mean, I know I always worry when things are fashionable because it's fashionable now to be honest with kids. And I always have this vision of in 20 years' time, they're like, oh my God, can you believe they used to tell children everything? Like now, we think about Findus Crispy Pancakes and what my mum used to feed me. Apologies, mum. I know she listens. But like, I cry in front of my daughter, which my mum once said to me, oh, don't let her see you upset. And I was like, why? Like, surely that's how we teach them that miscarriages may happen. It's okay. Like my mum went, like, I think that's amazing that you were able to communicate that with her. That's a testament to your guys' relationship. Definitely.
I don't think it was intended. I think that's the thing.
No.
It was a bit of a, I think sometimes there is overspill.
Yeah.
And actually I didn't realise how it ended up being a great thing, but it could have gone one of two ways.
It could have done, but I think there's something in those stressful moments where you make that decision and there's someone in your brain that knows that's the right thing to do. Like sometimes when you're under great stress and you are emotionally vulnerable, you do make that choice because somewhere in your heart you're like, yeah, that is the parent I want to be. And actually I know my daughter will be there for me. But it's hard. I think sometimes you don't know that till you're sitting on the toilet crying. Do you know what I mean? Like you wouldn't intentionally think, I'm going to tell her about my miscarriage. Like I don't think any parent makes that choice. But
today we are going to talk miscarriage and inviable fetuses.
To a three-year-old, that would definitely be quite intense. But if they see you, that's what I mean. Like I can't remember what I was upset about, but I didn't make the choice for her to see it. She was just there. And I thought, well, I could walk out the room or I could just stay in the room and cry and then get better.
Yeah.
And then hopefully she'll see that, oh, mummy cried and then she talked about it and then it was okay, rather than like, when you cry, run away. Don't let people see the black tears.
The black tears.
Black tears is a beautiful phrase. That's wonderful.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So was that your second miscarriage?
That was a fourth one.
Fourth one. Oh, right. Yes, so after May. So... Sorry, I'm just get the timeline. Sounds like something very factual.
It's okay.
And uncaring. But so you had that first
call
one.
It the grief line.
The grief line. The grief line, yeah. And then you had another two before May came along.
Yeah.
So how did you feel when you were pregnant with May? Was that that must have been a very stressful pregnancy. Were you constantly kind of on edge? Or did you hit a point that you thought, okay, she's definitely here? Or
did you have anxiety through pregnancy?
I had massive anxiety because I am... so anxious as a person. And I did worry about, I mean, again, I've interviewed the comedian Sarah Barron about miscarriage, and she was astounded that I hadn't had a miscarriage before. I just got pregnant and it was all right. And so I didn't have that. I worried about it a lot, but I hadn't experienced it. And I do feel very privileged because miscarriages are so common. My friend Sarah was like, what is wrong with you? Like, why haven't you had one?
Yeah. I was like, you're not the one in four.
Yeah. And I was like, oh yeah, I feel very lucky that, but again, you know, I've only had one child. We've only tried and yeah. You know,
even the chat around trying makes me feel a bit sick.
Yeah,
like
the, I know. Yeah.
We're trying really hard. You know.
So I was very anxious the whole time I was pregnant, but it was more just a general death. Either her dying or me dying. But that's my general death anxiety. Because I do have death anxiety because of my dad. So I just had this... And my thing was always like, what if I die before she... You know, before I can do anything? Because that's my fear, is the parent going.
I was thinking that. I was on a flight last week and I was thinking exactly that. I've never had death anxiety before having children.
Yeah.
And it is that sense of... we were just on a flight and I was just... considering the exact moment the plane went down, what I would do, would I know how to do the oxygen mask? Because I never listen.
I never listen.
I'm like, I really should start listening to this stuff because she needs me. It's not just me anymore, you know.
I think when you lose a parent young, you just get death anxiety sooner. So I've had it since I was 15, like that fear of like, but what if my mum dies, my brother dies, if I die, like... And most people I know go, oh, once I had a child, I suddenly thought, oh my God, I'm important. Whereas when you lose a parent young, you're like, I know what parents do. Yeah. So I don't want to lose another one. Like, yeah. I know what that shit is like. Guys need to stop taking drugs, stop taking planes.
Mum, look left, look right, then cross the road.
Yeah, you get very like a parent.
Well,
you know?
When May crosses the road, because I'm so anxious about, like that, she literally declares, I will not die. And it's quite sort of dramatic. She looks left, she looks right. I will not die.
I will not die. Good. Get it. Start them early. Start them early.
People are looking at me like, guys. Wow, that's quite, it's quite intense parenting. I was like, it is important.
It's important that she doesn't die while crossing the road.
Guys. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, oh, yeah, whatever gets you across the road. That's how I feel. If that works, it works. So, yeah, when I was pregnant, I was anxious, but from a very different perspective, I think, than someone who'd already lost a child, I think. So is that how you felt when you were pregnant with May? Did you have the constant... am I going to even get to the end of this?
It's probably similar to the kind of fear of death that you have in terms of when you've experienced loss of a child. And I keep saying loss of child because the whole miscarriage, the word is just so clinical and inviable fetus. And I remember the doctor saying, the fetus will pass. I'm like,
what?
I have a name. I'm like, I have a name. And I think that's what something Elle from Feathering the Empty Nest does very well. Her book's called Ask Me His Name.
Yeah.
And I think there is an element that within the medical profession where that is absent. And so you're kind of... when you've lost lives along the way on the journey to having a child, I think every time I went to the toilet, I was checking for blood. Every single time. It was like knicker roulette. Oh, it's God. The only way I can describe it.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sickening feeling. And I did bleed a couple of times.
Oh,
and
God.
it's uncontrollable. You're sobbing within seconds because you're feeling in the gusset of your knickers that life ebbing away. You feel it's going and there's nothing you can do.
You're so out of control. I think that's the thing.
You can't, there's nothing you can do. Within you. It's not something that you feel that, you know, you can, look, let's get a oxygen mask on. Yeah. Let's find a medical way to do this. It's something, it's a tiny, tiny life that is ebbing away from you. And I think when you've lost babies along the way to, as Matt calls it, splashdown. He's quite basic in his pregnancy terms. You do have that innate fear of, bleeding, of losing. And you know that the medical profession isn't set up for that grief. And I think that's the bit that was really difficult is...
We talked about on Sarah's episode as well, because she was saying even the word miscarriage, it applies from like 2 weeks to... you know, 8 months, like they admit, like, or it, there's, we're missing the language for what that is because it's so painful. Yeah. So I think it's that thing of people just go, or have done for hundreds of years of, well, we just don't know what to say. So we're just not going to invent a word for that. Like we have how many words for rain, mist, drizzle, mise, like we have all this stuff for weather, but to say
miscarriage,
it's to horrible. Sum up all this stuff, it's where language fails, which is unusual for the English language.
As the person that really helped me was, it's the difference between empathy and sympathy. And it was one of my best friends, and I'd miscarried for the third time before we had May, and I felt this is it. I actually decided that I had my family already, which was Matt, a curmudgeonly Scot with a very strong eyebrow game. I was like, that's my family, Matt and the two eyebrows, which sounds like a really dodgy band.
I will pluck them well.
I will pluck them well, and I will maintain that brow. And I felt I had my family, and I'd given up. Yeah. I'd totally given up.
Of course, I completely understand that.
And my friend Pippa, she sort of sat me down. She sat in the hole with me. She didn't say, are you okay? There's nobody that can respond, I think, to any kind of grief with, well...
No, not really.
I don't really know where to start. And she sat with me in the hole. She stacked up the Jaffa cakes. She put a cup of tea on. And she said, I want to make you the godmother of my daughter. And it was a moment, just one woman sitting in a hole with another woman, giving me a role in a child's life that at that point... I didn't think I'd have. And I think I will never forget what she did. She didn't try and rationalise my grief. She didn't try and help me understand. She didn't do anything other than cup of tea, Jaffa cakes and a role in her daughter's life. And I think it got me out of a hole. And I'll never forget her for that. And I made her my daughter's godmother. And I think it's those moments that when I thought I wasn't going to come through this with a family that I had in my mind, that I realised it's the people around you. It was Pippa. She was my family. Matt's my family. My sister. We had a goldfish at the time called Frederick. It was actually Frederic with a very French, with a Q-U-E at the end. It was very, very Parisian. And it was really cobbling together those bits that I hadn't seen as a family.
Yeah.
And that was actually, bizarrely, 3 weeks later, I got pregnant with May.
Wow. Oh, my God.
But it was when I'd given up. Yeah. And
it is like, what an amazing woman. Because I think, as ever with grief, people just worry about doing the wrong thing. And I can imagine her thinking, oh, is this going to go down badly? Someone going to be like, I don't want to be your fucking godmother. You know, like, but to just try, like you said, to just climb down in the hole and just offer something rather than, like, questions, which can be so much pressure on the person to be like, well, I don't know if I'm okay. I don't know if I have the language to say, but just to say, well, here's a thing. What do you think?
It was exactly that. It wasn't sort of a dramatic fanfare with, you know, doves and pigeons going, I know that you obviously can't have children, so I'll give you a role in Imogen's life. It was, you're my mate, you know, she could do with some, like, guidance. I was like, guidance on... Bear in mind, I was the vice editor at Time Out at the time. I was like, guidance on dildos? Hey, I mean, I can offer that.
A girl's going to need that eventually.
I know a lot about the purple pulsator.
Not yet, but eventually you're going to be the very cruel godmother. Eventually that is going to play out so well. Well done, Pippa. She thought ahead. But yeah, I just think that's... Oh, it's so hard because I think that's the problem. People, they don't know what to do. They're afraid of doing something wrong, so they do nothing. And that's and then that becomes pain. And they feel stunted because they're like, well, I didn't do anything, so I'm ashamed. And the person who's grieving feels a pain of, well, you didn't reach out. And then that friendship almost dies because it's like, well, I stuck my hand out and you weren't there.
And I was fucking angry at anyone who was pregnant. Oh, I mean, I was savage. You know, I just became this savage that was sort of papering over the cracks, like pretending to be okay. And then crumpling on the metro in Amsterdam. We were living, seeing a Pampers ad. You know, it was, I was just like, I'm fine. And I don't think anyone that says I'm fine.
It's fine.
It's fine. Never. I've seen that on many comedy sketches and I kind of agree with it entirely. Like it's... Because if any, when you go beyond I'm fine, like, I don't know, where would you start? Like, you know, I mean, I'm snot bubbling on, you know, in the red light district as people are walking past going, Dave, let's go get some gear from here. And, you know, I'm like, why are you crying, love? I don't know, I'm just, I lost a baby. Yeah. And I, you know, there's no, and I think many people have heard say it, and I think I concur, is just at least you can have children. Well, yeah, at least it's not helping if someone's lost a leg, you know. It's not, well, at least you've got an arm.
Yeah,
it doesn't help.
I think it's trying to make things better. And of course, and again, it's trying to, which I try and do the show, break down the hierarchy of grief. Like, it's not that, well, Anna can be sad, but then she had two kids, so she's not allowed to be more sad than the lady that didn't have children. Like, I just don't
it's
think
not
it
like
works
grief
like
top trumps.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm the Yoda of grief.
And I really do believe, listen to this show, like, you know, you'll have people come on and they're more bereft about their granddad than perhaps I was ever about my dad. But that doesn't make their grief more better than mine. It's like, it's who you are. It's different. It's how you feel about things. And, you know, it's not how life works. You can't categorise it. You know, you can't, like we said, be that medicalisation, you know, just very, like, blank about it. And actually, that's not what May did to you when she was saying that. May was being very... simple about it, which is not unemotional.
And she, our neighbour Derek, died from next door, and I had built up telling her over 12 hours. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to break it to her. This is just going to be awful. She came back from school. I sat her down. May, I've got something very sad to tell you. I'm afraid that Derek has died. And I looked her in the eye, and it was just silence. And she said, can I have his teddy bear? Because he had a teddy bear that his wife, before she passed away, had given to Derek. I mean, this is just a chain of grief and teddy bears from, like, sponsored by Clinton's. I mean, it, you know. And I sort of looked her in the eye. I was like, I'm sure you can. Are you okay? And she was like, yes. And then my husband came back and he just said, Derek's dead.
Yeah.
I was like, God, like, I'd built this up. And clearly, you know, she was sad, but the way that she compartmentalised things is different to me. You know, I'm not...
under 10, they basically, what the grief psychologists say, under 10, you don't know what dead means. It doesn't mean, you can't understand forever because you've only had, you know, 4 years of forever.
She's just aware they're all getting mashed up in heaven.
Yeah,
that's kind
exactly.
of the vibe, and it sounds like quite a cool place. Yeah. So why would you be sad? And I get the teddy bear. So
yeah, exactly. And that's the thing of just come back to, like, but you preparing it in a sad way, or you being sensitive to her being sad, is all that matters. Like, that's all that a child needs, is just to someone to be, rather than you her coming in and being like, Derek's dead, May. Like, that would be the inappropriate reaction. Of like, so I think that's. God, like, it's just trying to do your best, and then if you get it wrong, trying to be okay with that.
And me being accepting, I'm going to be sobbing outside our house just seeing a skip with all of Derek's old things in it. Yeah. There's family clearing out. Like, I just saw an old cornflakes packet. And you just, you know, like, I overthink every all minute details of that person's life. I'm like, was that the last cereal we had? You know? And it's so, just processing it in a very different way. And my husband's very, I remember when he lost his father, he would not say anything. He didn't say a thing. He just closed up like a clam. And the way I got through to him was simply by holding his feet. Aww. I literally just held his feet, like his, well, I say feet, like they're pretty, it was a big, big thing on my part because they look like claws. They're pretty rank. I'm not going to lie, like, I wouldn't normally go near them, the trotters.
I was being very nice wife, guys.
Yeah, I was doing a really good thing there. But he had these trotters out and I didn't know how to talk to him because he really didn't want to talk about it. And I just held his feet for about an hour. Like, it was bizarre. Anyone looking in would be like, what the frick are you guys doing?
That's so interesting because we talked about another Kaylee Llewellyn's episode about when she lost six members of her family in a year. And she had this thing that she had to take her shoes and socks off and she had to go and stand on grass. And it's actually known as grounding. It's like a thing they recommend that you do is that you just get your feet out of socks and you stand on the earth or something. So you holding his feet is like some primal urge to ground him and bring him back. But like, again, we don't know we're doing these things. We just think...
We're all just monkeys.
Yeah, exactly. We are like, just figuring it out. Like going, will that work? So you had May. Obviously, must have been incredible. And then... When you started trying again, so how long was the next miscarriage after, how old was May?
She was 3 years old. So she was three. When she asked for Zion.
Right, which I was like, did that, must have been very painful to go back to those feelings after having had the joy of a child. Because that's, I think, whenever someone near me has cancer or anything, I get very edgy. I'm like, oh, because I feel like almost like time is ripping me back to those places. And it's like... You know how hard you fought to get out of that hole and you've talked to people and you've worked your way out and then that feeling again must have just like snapped.
It's like a jigsaw piece suddenly slotting back again, like going back in the past. You've taken that jigsaw piece out and separated it from that black kind of darkness and then suddenly it slots back into place and it feels that complete picture of grief again.
Yeah.
It was... Like I say, gusset roulette. Yeah. It was just, I had to become quite practical because obviously I had a child and I couldn't be...
Yeah, so it must have been different to the first time round that you can't sort of collapse. You're not allowed.
No, it felt like, I have a bit of more of a responsibility here to not be breaking down and delivering the black tears at every fight, within Tesco every time I saw sort of Pampers... ad or shelves of children's things. I do remember being in Asda and I had what was known as pregnancy sort of psychosis. So you have flashbacks and dreams around baby loss and it's all very kind of hallucinogenic almost.
So this is after the miscarriage?
Yeah, it was when I wrote a piece for The Telegraph about it and UCL have done a lot of research on it and I felt I was going absolutely mad.
Yeah.
I was dreaming and then actually having visions of having left May in a car park and just walking away and then not knowing where she'd gone and knowing there was a loss and it was a loss of her and then it was obviously a loss of the child that I was miscarrying. And it would just, I was with May when I had one of these kind of strange hallucinogenic, I said it's not hallucinogenic, but it felt very much like a kind of fucked up acid trip of grief. And I was in the Asda toilets, which I'm not going to recommend as a as a place to grieve.
Yep.
You know, there was, let's just say there was some there's a little bit of soiling in there that didn't help the mood. And again, I just, all these moments happen in toilets. Like, and I was miscarrying with my daughter there, and this was the time before I'd miscarried in the nursery. And I was always with May when it was happening.
Yeah, of course. You've got a small child,
And you're just kind of like, wow, what is going on here? And I felt like, I remember seeing the emergency cord and thinking, that's just for people who fall down the toilet or people who can't stand up. That is not for a woman who has, and I remember thinking the words, just lost a child. Mm. You know, I knew how many people it happened to. It was normal. It happened to a lot of people. Why am I unhinged in the Tin Goods aisle of Asda? And actually, it's exactly what you said. I think people process loss in such different ways that you can't chastise yourself.
No, you can't.
For tripping out on some fucked up acid trip in Asda, going into the toilets, thinking about pulling the red cord. I mean, I'm, to be honest, it was with me the most exciting thing I'd ever done. You know, like, just to see what happens. We've got a code
right?
red.
Yeah, some poor janitor. Have you fallen over? Not quite, no. I'm having extreme hallucinogenic experience through grief. Can you help me?
Are you okay?
I'll fetch the manager.
I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm fine. She said she was fine, everyone. Good. But I just... That's the thing, it's like... Grief is grief. Like, and I know people who've lost parents haven't cried. Suddenly a dog dies, they're in pieces. Like, yeah. It's not, your brain protects you from a lot of stuff. And I imagine if, you know, you had May and you were grieving this loss and you're trying to hold yourself together, I'm not surprised that your brain was like slightly not processing everything properly, because you couldn't, because you've got a kid to look after. And I know I've had some weird moments when you're so exhausted from looking after them and them not sleeping and trying to be the good mum that you really want to be. And then you're just doing something thinking, I don't think I'm all right, actually. I think I might not be okay. And it's normally when you just have to get yourself home, isn't it? Just get yourself home, have a cup of tea and hope that by the time you get home, somehow you manage to make a sentence.
You've sellotaped over the kind of cracks.
But you are, like you said, you're sellotaping over cracks. And I can imagine wanting to grieve and not being able to must have been really fucking hard, because you have got that 3-year-old who needs you to put the beans on toast and smile and be silly. And yeah, it's really...
And Matt's way of dealing with grief is to swallow it and shit it out. And
classic.
That's... So
classic IBS route for grief. I mean, he's not alone. There's a lot of us out there.
Hashtag sponsored. Hashtag... Rennie's.
Yeah.
Like that's how he deals with it. So it felt like I was a little bit of a grieving, hallucinogenic, kind of not okay, but having to be island. Is it archipelago?
Yeah, felt like a group of islands.
A group of islands with lots of different things going on.
Yeah,
feeling like I should be one island that's secure for my daughter, when actually my head was all over the place.
Like, what's your grieving? You're grieving.
But like I said, Matt, just suck it up, shit it out.
Well, if you can.
If that's what works.
If it works, great. But that's the thing, again, of that having non-judgment, I think, is really important. Like, even my... when my husband, he's lost his dad and his mum, you know, he dealt with things very differently both times, and he dealt with things differently to me. And I would often have to think, Carriad, you know, he's not doing the grief the way you do it. That doesn't mean it's wrong. You know, like sometimes I'd be like, we need to talk about it. We need to get this out. You need to share. And he'd be like, I just want to sit and be quiet. And I was like, no, we need to, everyone needs to talk till we cry. And he was like, I just want peace. Like, oh, and it's
please leave me alone.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I see, you're grieving in that way. Okay. And it's really, because we don't talk about it, you know, it's not taught in schools. Like, most of our parents' generations didn't talk about it either. So we're like dealing with the biggest thing we'll have to deal with no fucking textbook at all. And I talk about this so much. Like, parenting now, I think there's, you know, you're part of that massive, amazing movement, which is like, let's talk about the other side of it. Let's talk about how it can be hard or it's difficult. And death is still slightly behind parenting, of like, actually, guys, there might be other bits that we have to talk about that you know, that in modern day life are not as painful as we think they are. If
there's,
we talk
moments
about them.
Of laughter in the darkest places.
Oh God. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's the bit that really shook me.
Yeah,
is exactly that. Like, listening to the grief cast, I think I said to you, helped me more than I think any kind of counselling, and it's different for everyone, but it was being able to process other people's grief, see how it was a spectrum of different colours, different that there was laughter in it, and it's not funny, but there is lightness in that dark.
I always say it's not funny they died, because I don't want people to be like, oh, she, like, it's like, it's not funny they died, but what happened around it was funny. And that's the difference.
Can the next one be black?
Yeah, exactly.
Let me see.
I want to be honest with her. So let me explain. This is what needs to happen if you want a brother who isn't white. Okay, we're going to have to find someone. We're going to, like,
I don't think Pop will be happy with this.
Yeah, but if that's what my child wants, I want my child to have everything she wants. And so then you got pregnant with your second daughter.
Yeah, Evie.
So again, like, was it just, again, the Gusset Roulette playing every day? You must have been so stressed out. I can't imagine. Like,
I think by that point it was just a bit numb.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember it was the same kind of pregnancy anxiety, but obviously through sharing a lot of information around miscarriage, and I wrote that piece for The Telegraph about kind of hallucinations and the slight psychosis around pregnancy anxiety when you have not just miscarriage. I found out it wasn't just miscarriage. It was people who had that innate fear of death, of actually losing something, even that you know they hadn't lost before, but they had that fear of doing that. And I think by sharing so much, what I'd done was open the floodgates to a lot of conversation, which was good and bad at the same time.
Yeah, and a bit like this, right? You're really happy to have that. Like, I love doing the Greekcast, but then I get a lot of emails, which. I love when people share their stories, but there's days when you're not in a good mental space to deal with it. So then
exactly.
If you were pregnant, that must have been really tough to...
And there was one point where I genuinely like had that hysterical... I can't quite replicate the noise, but it was a laugh cry. Like, it was so happy.
I'm nodding, yep. Yeah.
It was just didn't know what sound it was. It sounded a little bit sort of like a constipated llama. You know, like it's the only way I could describe it. And it was a woman who'd had 8 miscarriages.
Wow.
And we'd been in touch for about 2 years. And she sent me, I was about 5 months pregnant, she sent me a photo of her daughter that was born. And I made the constipated llama noise because it was a fusion of extreme delight and happiness for her and extreme fear and sickness of...
So you're like, I can't look yet. I can't look at your finish line yet because I'm not quite there yet.
And then it's like selfishness. Well, come on, embrace the happiness.
No.
But there's such trauma embedded.
You have to process your own trauma. I think it's really important to be self-aware to go, and I need to learn this. But like, you can be delighted once your baby's out.
I've got the stress sniff.
Yeah, you're stress sniff. I've got the stress sniff.
Yeah, we've both got the snot bubble, black tears, stress sniff.
Because you have to be very gentle with yourself. And I think that's the thing, when something traumatic has happened to you, whether it is, you know, the death of a parent or the death of a child or death of a sibling, that's trauma and it gets into your bones and your muscles and it hurts and it's painful. And so, you know, you have to make sure you're healed. And equally, like if someone was like, oh, look, this is a bad metaphor, but like if someone's like, oh, look, my massive cut's healed. And if you were still bleeding, you'd be like, oh, hang on a second. Like, I need to put plaster on my first, before I...
Bit of disinfectant on that.
Yeah,
it's got a bit of gangrene.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just being so gentle with yourself. But again, it's so easy to feel that your grief is selfish. And I do think as well that the language around miscarriage, which I think... The fact that it's common is really great that people know it, but then I notice it gets swept away sometimes, like, oh, well, it's common, these things happen. And I speak to people going, oh, we had one, but, you know, it happens. And I think, oh, we didn't even get a moment for that feeling. Like, and it's great that people know it's common so they don't think, oh, my God, something's wrong with me.
Yeah,
but
you're not alone,
you're
but
not
it's
alone,
still grief.
But you are allowed to, even if it was 2 weeks, like you are allowed to go, oh, I'm sad about that. Like, I'm actually a bit
and
upset.
And you're also okay too if you feel it's...
Yeah, if you feel
like,
fine
if you
about
can,
it, yeah.
I think I know a few people who genuinely have compartmentalised it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've had long conversations and tried to talk about feelings.
Yes, yeah.
Because I've had, obviously, a experience of a lot of people's grief around miscarriage that, you know, I have with a very close friend who did miscarry. I did want to dig deeper and, like... Are you sure you're okay? Are you okay?
Yeah.
You kind of keep sort of pecking away. And actually, she genuinely did compartmentalise in a way that I couldn't.
Yeah.
And I think it's exactly what you said, is there are this myriad of ways of dealing with it. And every way is okay as long as you are allowing yourself to grieve in the right way or to compartmentalise if that is how you do it, but not to your own. Don't do the sort of Matt Fox and like, suck it up, shit it out.
That's what I mean about self-aware. You have to know, am I just papering up the cracks or am I actually fine? Like, I didn't see it as I've lost a baby, I bled and it's gone and it's fine. Like, and that's, both ways are utterly fine. It's funny, I think this is happening with birth as well, that now people don't, no one expects everyone to have birth the same way. Like, we're very aware now of like, no, you know, it can be a wonderful experience or it can be a very traumatic experience. There's a huge spectrum. And that's great that that's happening. But with grief as well, it's like, we don't all grieve the same way. We don't all fall in love the same way. Like, huge emotional things. Like, you meet people who go, oh, I saw them instantly across the room. Boom, that was it. And you meet people who go, oh, I knew them for 20 years and didn't realise. Like,
oh, I'm still not sure. I'm still,
I don't know, he's on a trial and he's doing all right. But, you know. Yeah.
Two kids deep, mortgage.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I can't get out.
I can't be asked.
I mean, they say it's equal rights, but it's very hard for us to extract yourself from a mortgage.
Yeah.
I'm joking. But yeah, like to grieve. We all grieve differently, and I've had friends who've had abortions or had miscarriage, and they're absolutely fine. Just like, yeah, don't really think about it, and that's absolutely fine. But if it affects you differently, equally, then you need the different process, and you need to look after yourself more gently. And yeah, not everyone suffers from anxiety. Like, I think no. That is, oh, I don't know who you are, like, on where you are, and I hope you're having a really nice time because I can't imagine what it's like not to worry constantly. But I hear people, some people tell me.
But do you worry about a lot of things, or is it focused?
Yeah,
this isn't a therapy session. No, I'm just trying to get in your head.
I worry about a lot of things. Yes, so I'm a worrier, definitely, as I used to call anxiety. I'm just a bit of a worrier, but definitely the death anxiety is at the root of it. So that's the sort of compulsive. I'll definitely be someone who's like, oh, should I have said that? Should I have done that? Did I look at them weird? Maybe I shouldn't have worn that. Do they think I was an idiot? Oh, I probably... That's constant. But I feel like, what can we do about that? That's who I am.
Yeah.
But the thing I try and work on is they're like, oh, they didn't call me. I suppose they're dead. Or I'm walking across the road. I'm probably going to die. I wonder how people cope when...
You just need to be with May. Yeah. You will not die.
Yeah, you will
not...
Yeah, I need that.
You
I need
some reassurance.
May. You will not die. Yeah, and maybe I'll say this because it might make someone feel better, but my constant death anxiety was like, oh, okay, you know, if one of us dies, because that's what I grew up with and I just want to protect her from it. And then I was like, I think I was on the loo and I was like, no, I was on the train. And I was thinking, it could be awful if one of us dies. Oh my God, what if we both die? And it never occurred to me. And I was like, oh, thank you, anxiety. You presented me with the actual worst event possible. Because all this time I'd be like, okay, if one of us die, if I die, fine. He's a good parent. I've chosen well. He'll look after him. And I was like, oh. So now that's what I'm now trying to process, is if we both die.
I'm just thinking of the party. I literally like plan my own funeral. I keep constantly thinking of what would the song be? Yeah. Would that get enough tears?
You want black tears.
Yeah,
you
yeah, yeah. Tears, I wouldn't want so-and-so there. Like, they're a massive dick. Like, I'd like, well, should I do the guest list now just so they know? You know?
Yeah. Well,
and I don't want like dry sandwiches. I want them to make sure that the sandwiches are, you know, like they've got one of those boxes over them. Like,
And go to Waitrose, guys. Get a good
sandwich. No, I don't want a bit more thought to it than that.
Okay.
Sorry.
Like, sandwiches.
Oh, you're not coming to my funeral.
I've done the cardo order for Anna. I think it's fine. I put some cling film on it.
Do you want a sausage roll though? But artisan one, ideally. Chopped up. Yeah. God, and some gherkins.
Are you making me hungry?
Sorry.
So I was just wondering now, like, now you've had two children, obviously you might want more. Like, do you feel like you have processed what happened to those lives? Or I'm guessing I'm asking, and this is difficult for me when I do talk about miscarriage. I always feel a bit bad because I haven't been through it. Whereas the whole point of the podcast is I'm in the club, I fucking get it. And this is something I don't get. So do you feel like, yeah, I guess they, like you said, they're still part of your family in that way, of like they were lives that have been lost in that family?
Yeah, I think the best way of describing it is what has happened through losing these five lives. Mm. Is it's opened up a discussion with my mum, who lost two babies, which I didn't really know about.
Yeah.
And she told me, we had a long discussion when I was miscarrying with her. She, coming back to sitting in the hall together, she said, you do know that I lost two boys. And we were going to call them Mark and Paul. And they had names. And, you know, back in the 80s, like, nobody talked about grief. I mean, you think it's tumbleweed now.
Yeah. Like, oh, it's better than it was. Yeah.
It was really like, I'm fine. Yeah. And then, would you like a Ferrero Rocher? That was basically how to deal with grief in the 80s. And I think her using names was a real shock to me. And I was like 36 when we were having this discussion. And that was a really big moment, I think, was a mother helping her daughter go through something that she had experienced, a grief that she had not talked about to me, to anyone else. And she sat in the hall with me. And I remember just, laughing, again, coming back to that strange line between laughter and sort of the darkness, just going, why Paul? I mean, like, Paul is a, like, sorry to any Pauls out there, but I was just like, why did my sister get Mark? Mark's quite, like, you know, cool. I was like, why did I get Paul? She was like, we thought it was a lovely name. And we were just having them in this pit of kind of grief where you had a mother who was helping her daughter who was miscarrying in that very moment. And that night, I processed grief around miscarriage by practical DIY tasks in the house. Our house is immaculate now.
Great, yeah.
I tile, I grout.
I clean, I bleach.
Just
really
get into the nooks and crannies of that house. And I decided at 4 p.m. on a Saturday with my mum there that we needed to retile the kitchen floor. And it had four layers of lino that we just moved in and it was making me anxious.
Yep,
and
yep.
So Matt was like, the Scott. Right, like, no, now? I mean, it's 4 p.m. on a Saturday. We'll do it some other day or we can just wait. I was like, we can't wait. And my mum looked him in the eye and said, I'm going to B&Q. Went to B&Q, picked up everything, came back, and we retiled that kitchen floor for 8 hours straight until 5 in the morning. And that, again, was she didn't say anything. We just uncovered old lino with the old Waltham Forest echo coming up in between each layer from like 1976, side by side, sweating into the early hours, retiling a kitchen floor. And I hadn't known that she'd gone through what I'd gone through. And it was, again, just a woman helping another woman retile a kitchen floor.
Oh, like, that's so perfect. That's so perfect. What an amazing mum to just go.
But fuck the name Paul. Jesus Christ, mum. Like something a bit snazzier. I can't even believe I'm using the word snazzy.
It's a classic mum word. And so that's why you've gone there. Jazzy. That's us jazzy talk. Well, Anna, thank you so much for going to talk to me.
It's been cathartic.
Good. About those five lives. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can follow Anna on Instagram and on Twitter at mother_pukka, that's P-U-K-K-A. And if you head to her website, motherpukka.co.uk, you can order her book, Parenting the Shit Out of Life. You can watch her TEDx talk as well and just generally enjoy a whole world of very, very funny, frank and honest communications about being a parent. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at TheGriefCast, or you can email thegriefcast@gmail.com. If you have enjoyed the show, please do rate and review it and subscribe so you never miss an episode. We all have to say that. I think it's like legally binding now for a podcast. Music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.